Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 15th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Jerry Patterson. His topic, forgiveness is not excusing unjust behavior. Let's listen in.
This is the fifth session in forgiveness, and I've called it our most unused resource. I'm Jerry Patterson, and have recommended the book Forgive and Forget by Smeeds as a text for this course. And it's good to have you here. A little gimmick that I thought was kind of cute. He says, she says. A man is a person who, if a woman says, never mind, I'll do it myself, lets her. A woman is a person who, if she says to a man, never mind, I'll do it myself, and he lets her, gets mad. A man is a person who, if a woman says to him, never mind, I'll do it myself, and he lets her, and she gets mad, says, now what are you mad about? A woman is a person who, if she says to a man, never mind, I'll do it myself, and he lets her, and she gets mad, and he says, now what are you mad about? Says, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. I thought that was kind of cute. But it's the kind of stuff that the problem of forgiveness and revenge and all this is made up of. I wanted to just review the basic definition that I had given for repentance as forgiveness is making the choice to release the person who has wounded us from the sentence of our judgment, however justified that judgment may be. It's to release the person who has offended us, hurt us, done some evil that we think harmed us, but it's a suspending or setting aside the judgment on that person, even though it may be justifiable to make that judgment. They deserve it. And so we've been talking about that in various forms all week. It's to make a deliberate choice. If I've been hurt unfairly by someone, just to not to make that judgment, but to suspend it, as and you know, whether they deserve it or not. And my approach that I've been taking is, when we talk about forgiveness, it's really a long process. It begins with some hurt that we've experienced. It's our reacting to it in some way, and in its completed form ends up in reconciliation. The two who have been divided and cut asunder in some way, you know, are reunited together. But the point that I've tried to take in here is, let's not worry too much about whether reconciliation happens. It may never happen. Often it doesn't. And let's not worry about the other person too much, whether they are sorry what they did, they repent of it, they acknowledge they were wrong. Let's not worry about the other person. I think the key is to, for ourselves, to make the judgment, you know, to make the choice that we will not make the judgment on the other person. For our own sake, if not for the other person's sake. And in one way, it's kind of a selfish thing. Let's get the monkey off our own back so we can get out of this anger and frustration and hurt that someone has caused us. And let's not remain a victim to that. And forgiveness is the gift that we are given, that we can put a halt to that vicious cycle of hurt, revenge, and resentment, and, you know, we cut across it. And so what I thought I'd do is just refer to a number of things that Schmid has to say that I've kind of missed one way or another, haven't emphasized enough, and then we may reflect on those things. He says, if you cannot free people from their wrongs and see them as needy people that they are, you enslave yourself to your painful past. And by fastening yourself to the past, you let your hate become your future. You can reverse your future only by releasing other people from their past. You will know that forgiveness has begun when you recall those who hurt you, and you start feeling the power to wish them well. When the person has wronged us, when we actually want the best for them, then we know that forgiveness has happened on our part. Still, as long as we're angry, we're hurt, we're resentful, we really haven't completed the forgiveness act on our own part. Any reaction to that? Any like to comment about it?
Well, we have just gone through something where I had to forgive someone. We went through drugs with our daughter and when she was a teenager, and then we thought we were all over it, and now she's 32 with three gorgeous children and not a clue, and then all of a sudden we find out she's an alcoholic. And the anger I had towards her was just...
Mm-hmm.
And I forgave her, and now I can let her go, and we can have a good relationship. But I had to get through that to forgive her, to let her go,
mm-hmm.
to not hold any of that. I forgave her.
Has she dealt with her alcoholism effectively yet?
She went to a treatment center, so who knows after that?
You're hopeful.
Hopeful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, why people become alcoholics, you know, there's all kinds of factors involved there. And did you go through... some of the steps that many people go through? What did we as parents do wrong?
When she was a teenager, yes.
Yeah, teenager, but not now. Usually most parents have to work through that. Like, wait a minute, I must have done something wrong. I was at fault. Then, you know, judgment, and pretty soon.
It took a year of counseling.
Yeah.
Took
a year to do that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, we had her locked up, and it was we were into the real deep problems. And I'm a dry drunk too. I've been dry for 20 years. She's had to have two of us. I've been dry for 20 years. I quit in 1976. Mm-hmm. I'm probably still a dry drunk, and if you know what that means, I'm sure you do. Still carry some of the problems that led to the
right.
Over boozing, But I have more difficulty forgiving her than Joyce does. I have to confess that it's tougher for me to do, and I still carry a lot of resentment. And yet, I probably from my own background, I should be more understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a tough one.
What's the problem that you have? What's the problem? Why are you having such a problem forgiving her?
With her? I guess that my problem is that she has just always represented the upheaval, chaos, instability to me, and even in times when she's been fine, or outwardly fine. I still, I'm waiting for Vesuvius to erupt. And so it leads to uneasiness, and I guess maybe that's the reason that, and then I probably resent, she's on the phone to Joyce four times a day, as a woman. We lived close, and she had every opportunity to live far away, and she was an American Airlines flight attendant, and she graduated from college, and she had opportunities to have careers and what have you, and marriages far away, which sounded wonderful to me, but nothing happened like that. She comes back, and she's right in our midst again, you know. And I guess I resent that, and that probably stands in the way of forgiveness, doesn't it? And you still you remember all of the days when she was going to burn our house down and shoot us and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess the memory's long, and that stands in the way, I suppose. I don't know.
I tell you what, let's come back after a couple of more things we're going to talk about. Maybe we can throw a little bit of light and help on that. Is forgiving an honorable way to come to terms with the pain you feel when a responsible person stings you deeply and unfairly? Well, what's the alternative to forgiving? Must you freeze yourself in the unfairness of a cruel moment in the past or the present? Do you want your private world to stand still at that wretched incident in your irreversible history? Or are you ready to find a better way? Better than what? Better than the pain of a memory glued forever to the unfairness. But suppose you do refuse to settle for the past, and you also refuse to give forgiver. Is there another option? Revenge, vengeance, all kinds of things. Well, or no two people, no two families ever weigh pain on the same scale. The pain a person causes me always feels heavier to me than it feels to the person who caused it. The pain I inflict on you always feels worse to you than it seems to me. Pains given and pains received never balance out. The difference between pain given and pain suffered is like the difference between climbing up a hill and scampering down the hill. It never feels the same both directions. If you hurt me and I retaliate, I may think that I've given you only what you deserve, no more. But you feel it as a hurt that is too great for you to accept. Your passion for fairness will force you to retaliate against me, harder this time. And then it will be my turn, and it will never stop. Revenge locks us into an escalation of hurt and violence. Gandhi was right when he said, if we all live by an eye for an eye, the whole world will end up blind. The only way out is forgiveness. Forgiveness is not the alternative to revenge because it is soft and gentle. It's a viable alternative because it is the only creative route to unfairness. Forgiveness has creative power to move us away from a past moment of pain, to unshackle us from our endless chain of reactions, and to create a new situation in which both the wrongdoer and the wronged can begin a new way. Forgiveness offers a chance at reconciliation. It's an opportunity for a life together instead of death together. Gee, I think he wrote this. He wrote this to any of us who are struggling with the problem of forgiveness. It's interesting that how many times has somebody done something and the other person says, well, you know, you did this thing to me, and, you know, it was really, really terrible. And the other person says, well, what do you mean it was terrible? I just said that little thing. I mentioned something, but the reaction to it, the response to it, is totally out of proportion what was intended. But this scale of hurt, it never balances. The hurt person always understands it so much more profound or heavier. And of course, since I was hurt so badly, then I respond in like. It's the most natural thing in the world. It's instinctual. It's the natural thing to do. And of course, my response, which I think is, you know, this at this level, the other person interprets it at this level. And so we're into this. Forgiveness is the only way to somehow cut through that and make it possible for a healing and possible for a reconciliation. But even if the reconciliation never comes, forgiveness is the only way to at least get the monkey off our own back, because the past, the hurts, have just got us tied up into a very, really a destructive pattern. And we're not using our best skills and our gifts, you know, to deal with the situation, because they're all colored by the hurt and the pain that this pushes from the past. The difficulty, of course, is that we're not talking about a rational process so much. I know all kinds of people that have given great sermons on forgiveness, you know, but it's a head trip, who themselves are not able to live it out. This author makes quite a point that we are not, forgiving is not the same thing as forgetting. And he argues that we ought not to forget, because, first of all, you don't have to forgive somebody unless the pain has been rather intense. If it's trivial, you don't have to forgive trivial things. So if it's not a trivial thing, we don't want to forget it, unless forgiveness has taken place and there's reconciliation, and then we may forget it simply because literally it's out of our past. It's no longer touching our lives. And now to forget it is not a sickness. But if I've been terribly hurt and somebody says, well, just forget it. You don't forget it. It's made such an impact on your life that you got to deal with it. Otherwise, you're just covering up the sore, and it continues to operate there and drives you. But he talks about redemptive remembering. Let's just look at this. I think it's kind of interesting. There is a healing way to remember the wrongs of the irreversible past. You can't change the facts. You can't change the past. That's a given. The only thing you do is, how are you going to respond to it? There is a healing way to remember the wrongs of our irreversible past, a way that can bring hope for the future along with our sorrow for the past. Redemptive remembering keeps a clear picture of the past, but it adds a new setting and shifts its focus on the past. No people can tell us about redemptive remembering better than the old Hebrews. Remembering was their lifestyle. Their memories told them who they were, how they fit into the human picture, what they were expected to do with themselves. Their future was born yesterday, And by remembering yesterday well, they discovered the meaning of their today and the goal of their tomorrow. Moses posted notice early on that the Hebrews' terrible yesterday had to be kept alive forever so that people would know the meaning of what was and what is and what shall be. Only take heed and keep your soul diligent, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children. But take a closer look at what the Jews were supposed to remember. It was not the horror of their 400 years of slavery, though slavery was their past. Not the titanic injustice of the Pharaoh in Egypt, though injustice was their past. They were not ordered to memorialize the evil. An astonishing feature of the post-slavery memorials is that the people are not urged to remember their misery. What had to be remembered was the miracle of survival and renewal. What had to be remembered were not the days when God was on leave of absence, but the days when God came back to bring them out of slavery and out of suffering. The Passover feast was their memory day. The scriptures, Moses said, "This day shall be a memorial day. And when your children shall say to you, 'What do you mean by this sacrifice?' you shall say, 'It is a sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of Israel in Egypt when he slew the Egyptians and spared our houses.'" Release, liberation, redemption from pain, these were what were memorialized, not the bondage, not the wrong by itself. The monument was to the possibilities for the future, not to the horrors of the past. Redemptive remembering drives us to a better future. It does not nail us to a worse past. When Israel remembered its own past bondage, the memory incited them to seek justice in the present. "You were once strangers in a strange land. Remember not to be hospitable to the stranger in your own land. You were exploited by unjust masters. Remember not to exploit your own poor people. You were slaves once. Remember to set your own slaves free." Christian celebration is about redemptive remembering. The Lord's Supper, for instance. We remember that on the night in which he was betrayed, he took bread, took wine, and it's built around the cross. But what we're remembering is this is a liberation meal. It's a celebration meal. It's a meal that makes us who we are. All that we have has grown out of this hurt, and somehow we interpreted as somehow the action of God toward us, and it reminds us of what we are to be, who we're to be, how we're to relate to one another. It's redemptive remembering. My guess is that whenever we're faced with a situation where forgiveness is the thing we're challenged to, there's hurt, there's pain, there's maybe death as part of the memory. But is to pull out of that, how can this lead us to life in the present? Forgiveness is making a deliberate choice to set aside the judgment, even if it's justified, but to set it aside on the person that has wronged us. And it's not the natural thing to do. The natural thing to do is to want revenge, to want to strike back, to want to hate, to be angry, to be frustrated. But it's to make a choice to set aside the judgment on the person or the group or whatever it is that has wronged us. Strike any bells?
Maybe there's a difference between maybe forgiveness. I think you're talking, and this addresses itself to relationships that are broken, but maybe have to continue, as contrasted with a falling out at where you just want, hey, this person isn't for me. We march to two different drummers. We're not compatible, and I don't bear any ill will toward you. I hope you live a happy, full, wonderful life, but it's going to be without me, because I don't want anyone to do with you. You know what I'm saying? I don't want vengeance. I don't want revenge. I don't want. I want you to prosper and be happy. But I don't want to have any more. I don't like you. I don't want to, you don't like me. I don't like you. I don't want any more to do with you. Mm-hmm. Does that get to any of this?
Yeah, I hear that, and my brother was in a business relationship, and that's the conclusion they came to. And they could terminate the relationship and basically solve it that way. Some marriages are dealt with in that way. It's to recognize, I'm not angry, I don't want to fight you, or I want to wish you well, but we're not going to do this together.
Exactly.
It's tougher in a marriage than it is in a business relationship, I think, because you've shared so much. I'm sure there are times that it should happen.
I've seen bitter. I've dissolved hundreds, literally hundreds of partnerships. Medical, particularly doctors, turn into the absolute vengeful animals. They're unbelievable because most doctors don't have great business sense, and they learn to hate each other. And I've seen those that have been much more vindictive and much more animus than in broken marriages, and I've handled a lot of those.
Right.
Yeah, so really, the business thing, it can be terribly bitter, too.
I'm sure, because it goes deep into all kinds of skills as physicians, the incomes and stuff that come from it.
And the depth of ego.
Yeah. Oh,
the depth of ego.
That's got to be a big one for doctors,
yeah.
Because they really are God's right-hand man after a while.
Right. Well, you really are, but they claim to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. My guess is, it's a lot tougher between a child and a parent, or a parent and a child. I would almost think that would be the most difficult one to say, Let's accept that we march to different drummers, and we'll each go our own independent way, and we wish each other well, and there's no animosity or hurt or so. I think that's probably pretty tough in a parent-child. I know it's tough for a child-parent. A child, from the day they're born, independency is struggling in that relationship, and how do they become an individuation but somehow keep recognize the dependency and interdependency that ought to be there. And wow, for and every child goes through that battle being apart from parent, some more healthily than others, but almost every child has some unhealthy aspects of that.
And I think, well, like what you said about you can forgive, but maybe reconciliation is not in the game. I think between a parent and a child, there's so many unresolved issues between any parent and child that to say we'll go our separate ways, you're still carrying all that baggage with you.
Yeah, I think it must be very, very difficult from the child's point of view. It might be almost impossible to come to that conclusion. I don't know, from a parent's, it's tough. I have three children. The one's now 43, one's 37, one's 25. And that old balance, you know, how do you celebrate when they, as they grow up and grow away and make their own decisions, and sometimes wisely and sometimes foolishly, and boy, it's hard to know what the right relationship is. You, hey, as a parent, you want to be there, you want to give them whatever help, assistance you can. You also know that you got to keep your hands off. And, that's a tough one. And most of us don't get much help. Our educational systems don't teach us how to be parents or how to be children in a family. They teach us all kinds of stuff, but not that.
Right. No certificates.
No, there are none. And they're never completed either. And they keep changing. And having just hit my 70th birthday here a couple weeks ago, I recognize that I can see it already, that they're already starting to take almost a caring relationship to me. You know, it's like, hey, I kind of laugh about it once in a while, but I can see 5 or 10 years down the line, they're going to, and how do I gracefully accept this changing relationship to my kids? Your description of what, I take that's kind of how you've tried to deal with your daughter in this situation. It's pretty hard to do that. Because, well, what you said, she keeps coming back now. She telephones 4 times a day.
Not to me, to her mother.
Her mother, yeah.
Right. And it's, that gets a little frank. I'm not sure that your illustration, as far as I'm concerned, maybe as far as you're concerned, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't think your illustration of Carrie is really apt to what we've just heard. Because, I don't feel any animosity toward her. I just kind of wish she'd make her own life and that she wouldn't interrupt ours periodically. That's all. It's pretty simple.
Well, I felt it was very apt.
Let me ask the question. What is she phoning you for?
Oh, would you pick up a quart of milk on your way over? Or...
She reports on the kids' activities constantly, too.
We have 3 grandchildren. She calls and says, oh, so-and-so's tooth came through, just things men don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Why doesn't she call him?
Because he wouldn't be interested.
Hmm. Would she like him to be?
Very much. But that's not going to happen. She's accepted that.
Maybe.
You're right.
She knows that, whether she's accepted it
right,
or not.
Right, they don't ever accept that, that's right. But she's...
Well, is this the strategy you've been following? Is it working pretty good for you?
Oh, yeah. No, right. It works fine. And I have two... This is a stepdaughter. I have two sons. We've been married 30 years, but this child is just... She was a very tiny baby when we were married.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've known her whole life and, you know, been the kind of the in loco parentis
right. The
entire time. I have two sons that are the same, roughly 30, 43, 42, and 37, same ages as your sons.
Yeah.
I don't see any of them either. We have a congenial relationship when we see each other, but we probably don't. And they live close by, and I see them a couple times a year, maybe. You know, so I'm distant from all my... My family. I have a sister that's close by. I see her twice a year at the most, and so I'm really not very family
oriented. Kind of okay for you,
right? Yeah, it is, and it isn't a big problem, really.
Mm-hmm. Your lawyer?
Yes, retired.
And one of the good qualities about lawyers is they can deal factually with things.
Right.
You know, hey, let's lay at the cards at the table. Bang, 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 bang. Okay, here's the way to deal with that. Bang, bang, bang. Have you ever tried not to be a lawyer with this daughter?
I don't think so.
Maybe that's the problem. I've been away from the practice. I still have an office. I still have partners, but I don't practice law. And the great way to practice law is to have no clients. And I've been doing that for a number of years now. So it's wonderful. We travel the world and we have a good time. And so I don't think that the lawyer thing...
He's a hermit.
I wouldn't even... If you asked me what I did, I wouldn't tell you I'm a lawyer. Because I'm... You know, that's a terrible ego thing when you divorce yourself from your livelihood. Many people can never do it. They go to the grave in their work because they can't divorce themselves because that's their whole identity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've lost that identity long ago. I don't have that anymore. So I don't really think...
But you still think like that.
I probably analyze too much. And are you familiar with this thing she was talking about? What do you call it again?
Aneogram?
You know this aneogram thing?
Yeah, a little bit.
That people are typed a certain way.
Paul is seven.
Five.
He is the observer.
Analyze everything.
Oh, yeah.
And sit back and analyze people. You know,
yeah.
I do too much of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And he only wants people in his life when he invites them in.
Mm-hmm.
Never intruding.
Yeah.
Just like a pastor, he couldn't get away with that, could you?
No, couldn't. Although, yeah, many try to, many do.
Yeah.
He invites me in once in a while.
Well, let me repeat the definition that I gave of forgiveness. Making the choice to release the person who has wronged us from the sentence of our judgment. Do you think you've done that to your daughter?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think I... Well, I'm sure I'm judgmental with her, and I guess is that... I guess, is that what you're saying? I think we...
That's not forgiveness.
But one specific judgment of I think that's what that refers to, is a specific judgment on a particular grievance. That's the way I interpret what you've read. But I think a lot of us tend to be a little judgmental in everything we do, in the way we deal with other people. And that's just part of our nature, to just, we analyze and judge, don't we? Don't we all do this?
The judgment in this case isn't but a one single particular thing. It sounds to me like it's been from when she was 13, I heard that date, and now she's 32. It sounds to me like it's kind of some judgment about the entire, it's her lifestyle.
Yeah,
and
probably,
so on.
Probably.
Have you really I'm wondering, you gotta work with it kind of as a little exercise, just to, could I make a decision not to hold her, not to make judgment, not to place a judgment? She, that's the drummer she walks to, the beat she walks to. It's a different one than yours. It's different than you would like for her.
That's easy, though, for a non-family member. But the trouble with that is that when that poor decision, that poor judgment on her part, that misstep, can so often involve other members of the family in a deleterious way. Mm-hmm. You see, it's easy to do that, to not judge the conduct, the behavior, the activities of people that won't envelop you in their misdeeds, their miscues. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think there's a real difference there.
But she is going to keep pulling you back into it, if nothing else, because she makes phone calls today, and
right.
Mom, who has to be a mother and has to be sensitive to this and really wants to be, probably, too. And so if she could take your technique and style, it'd work a lot better, wouldn't it?
Yes, indeed. You bet.
On the other hand, if he would take a little more of your style, maybe it'd work better, too.
Relieve some.
But you each have different kind of ways of responding to this. Yeah. Pastor friend of mine got hit by, he had five sons. His fifth son, who was going to become a pastor, got through his college and went on to just getting ready to go to seminary. And he came to his dad one day and said, "Hey, Dad, I just got to be straight with you. My son, I'm gay." Father's world fell in. And he tells how he was angry. He felt guilty. What did we do wrong? Where did we fail? And then kind of just trying to dissociate himself from it. And then trying to, just live with it, but with some hurt and resentment. Finally, was able to celebrate the fact, hey, this is my son. He's still the same person. Until he said this, he said, "I was actually prouder of this son almost than any of the others." Happened to be the youngest one, too. And, but he tells how he had to deal with that whole process. And, he said, and then when it happened, then he started getting a whole different outlook on a whole class of people, in this case, gay, lesbian people, from a totally different point of view than he'd ever had before. And incidentally, he's now a bishop in our church. And I'm kind of happy that our church has been able to, it's one great big step forward that I really didn't think it was going to be able to do.
Did the son go on in the seminary?
Well, no, I guess not. He went on into the seminary, but he would not make the commitment. In our Lutheran church, right now our policy is that if you acknowledge being homosexual, you can be ordained if you promise not to be a practicing homosexual.
So you can have the inclination and that, but predisposition with,
yes,
but not practice.
Yes.
Then you could be ordained.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the church won't ordain you unless you make that commitment. Some of us, I'm part of a network against sexual discrimination in the church that says, wait a minute, they don't ask that of anybody else. They don't ask all kinds of questions about my private life.
Right.
They just say, you have to be a responsible person. You have to respond to Christ as you feel is honest and right, and we've picked out this one little behavior, and I would say that it's a very un-Lutheran thing to do, it's in our society today, we just haven't been able to deal with this because out of the past, we're inheriting all the bias that we've brought with us for centuries. But, it's interesting, we fought the same battle. There's a long time, boy, if you had been divorced, it was almost impossible to become a pastor. And we've come to terms with that now. We recognize, although we don't go around recommending people get, marriages and divorces and everything, we recognize there are right times for that. And so we haven't dealt with it in a legalistic way, but rather in a graceful way. So we still have to do that. But my point here for bringing this up is that this pastor finally got this monkey off his back when he could finally celebrate what was there.
Sure.
And my guess is that the options for you are to just kind of live with this irritating matter as best you can, because it ain't going to go away, because she's kind of round and keeps making contact and so on. But try to deal with it with an irritable situation that sure makes life a little less than as celebrative as I'd like it, because that's the only option I have. Or to somehow really, really forgive, in the sense of making a decision not to hold a judgment against the other person, in this case your daughter. And even though it's justifiable to make that judgment, and then maybe being freed from this irritating thing that keeps you from living as joyfully as you'd like to. You'd be interested, I talked in one of the earlier sessions, my experience in Africa. I was at the University of East Africa as the chaplain. We just organized the nation became independent. They immediately started a university, the first in the country of East in Tanzania. Now, we had a liberal art school, but we had the law school for the three countries that they were trying to bring into the East African Federation. Never worked out. But then the law school sort of on the side brought in magistrates from out of the bush, people who had been appointed as judges, magistrates, even though most of them had little education. They were tribal chiefs and so on. And we tried to introduce them to the conception of what Western law is. And they were not making much progress. So they asked me to come in and offer a few weeks of a course that I put together, psychology and sociology and a little Christianity, and tried to put a course that might be helpful. But these magistrates said, it's crazy. We come here and we find out these learned law scholars from all the Western countries, including Russia and England, the United States, East Germany, West Germany. He said, but their law is crazy. Two antagonists come together, there's some kind of a, suit brought, and the judge finally makes a statement, you're guilty, you pay a penalty of some sort, and both people go out. One guy says, I was robbed, they didn't hear me, they didn't listen. And the other guy says, man, I had to pay too much of a penalty. And he says, in our system, we listen to what the problem is, the complaints are, and we want them to talk and talk and talk, because our purpose isn't to make a judgment who is right and who is wrong. Our purpose is to reunite the community. And so we finally come to say, you know, you made a mistake in this, and you have to pay a penalty. It's maybe a cow or three cows or five chickens, or maybe it's monetary or whatever it is. But then the fellow says, yes, and I will organize a party, and we'll throw a party, and the offending people and his people will come, as well as the one who did the offending, and we'll have a party. We'll celebrate. And usually it may be for a day or two or three, you know? So that the goal is not to establish who is at fault and somebody has to pay a penalty. The goal is reconciliation, so that this is no longer something that existed. And he says, you're crazy. Western ways, there's no reconciliation. There's no, you know, everybody goes out angry and mad. Somehow something seems wrong about that.
Well, you hit upon what the change, that's the dramatic change that's now occurring. We have mediation now. We have alternative dispute resolution.
Beautiful.
And the reason it's happened is that, not for the good reasons that these folks indicated to you, the reason it's happened, that the courts are so clogged and litigation has become so expensive that we had to find an alternative. And it's happening, and people are going to walk away from those disputes feeling much better about each other than if they'd gone through a full-blown lawsuit. It's a real good point.
That's great. Yeah. That's great.
And it's happening in California and certainly in the state of Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a friend, a retired judge, who he says, I can work all the time now if I want. All I do is do these mediation cases.
Right.
He said, they handle, I think they handle 60% or something of the cases that come before the court in Santa Ana.
Sure.
Well, our time is up, and we kind of free-floated in this one today. And kind of nice.
Had our own private session today.
It's kind of nice. I've never considered myself a good counselor. And in fact, I did some special studies and training and came to a conscious decision that this was not my gift. But since I've been dealing with nonviolence, and that's what I dealt with last week, and that's where my real heart is, active nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
But this topic of forgiveness has come up, and I'm finding, well, I've done it in some congregations, and I honestly believe it's our most unused resource. We are not good at forgiveness, and I've often encouraged, whether it's individuals or in a congregational sense, what are some of the strategies you can use? And one of them is, what are all the beautiful things that I could remember about this person that's hurt me, so that I can get away from thinking only of the pain? Because if somebody hurt me, it's probably because they had some significance in my life. If they were unimportant to me, they probably wouldn't hurt me,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
Some guy out there that, you know, you're never going to see again, and he caused you some pain, well, you can probably slough it off. But if it's my kid or my wife or...